Hi, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. It's just an hour long, so you're missing two-thirds of the show. Plus, you don't have access to our archives with literally thousands, I think thousands, actually, maybe more than thousands, maybe tens of thousands, well, thousands of interviews that you would love. So do yourself a favor and become a member of Ring of Fire Radio. You can do so over at rofpodcast.com and realize that you are supporting independent media. It's our members who make this show possible. So please do everybody a favor. Head to rofpodcast.com, become a member. You'll be glad you did. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Dave Zirin from Edge of Sports will explain why Donald Trump's comments on NFL players might just be a cover-up tactic for his latest failings. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to help break down the important news stories of the week you may have missed. Nelson Dennis will be here to tell us about the law that's been strangling Puerto Rico for decades. And Justin Miller from the American Prospect will talk about Republicans' attempts to provide tax reform. Folks, don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help recap the week in news, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, obviously another crazy week in politics. But before we get to the state of play of the attack on our health care and the huge tax cuts Republicans are proposing for the rich, let's talk about this unfolding, ongoing humanitarian crisis that seems to be, I don't think it's totally being ignored, maybe not even largely, but it's certainly not getting the attention, both from the media and our government, that it deserves. And I'm talking about Puerto Rico, which is, and I don't even think it's accurate to say necessarily recovering. I mean, they're still, it seems to me, literally and figuratively treading water from the impact of Hurricane Maria last weekend. And it has been nothing short of stunning how reluctant our government seems to be to maintain the proper amount of urgency in this situation.
Well, I am astonished by what I've been watching unfold. Now, as someone, you and I both watched what happened with Hurricane Katrina and how that was one of those situations that we sort of saw. We saw it unfolding on television. We saw the government's lagging response. We saw them, you know, there were pictures of George W. Bush flying over and him holding a birthday cake with John McCain. And, I mean, it was a scandal of massive proportions. And the lesson from that, allegedly, was that any president that did not respond urgently to a major natural disaster like this would be, you know, held accountable for that kind of failure. It was largely seen as one of the things that in the Iraq War, which showed, you know, which pushed George Bush's approval ratings down into the 20s. So we've had this year, this is the third hurricane, that major hurricane that has hit United States citizens. I mean, it shouldn't take United States citizens to make anybody care, but, you know, let's face facts in America. Right. That's you know, how we do it. So we had Texas, and we had Florida, and now we have Puerto Rico. It's been a horrific hurricane season with major, major storms. So, you know, the president, Trump, the first two, he did a reasonably good job of following through on that you know, on that concept, that a president has to appear to be engaged, and they have to care, and they have to go and visit, and they've got to, you know, that there has to be some sense that he's watching it and that he is putting his attention toward this unfolding potential humanitarian disaster. And Texas is still having a lot of problems, which we're not even really paying attention to. But if you read the local press in Texas, the amount of toxins that are in the environment there
right.
is overwhelming, and it's an absolutely disgusting thing. By the way, hitting mostly a racial minority population, naturally. Florida, you know, kind of dodged the bullet pretty well, and they seem to have managed it pretty well. Puerto Rico is an absolute overwhelming disaster, getting worse and worse every day, and that happens to be the one that Donald Trump couldn't even find it in himself to mention until many days after it happened. And when he did, on his Twitter feed, he said, he said pretty much laid the blame on the Puerto Ricans themselves. Well, it's an old power grid, and they've got lots of problems. And by the way, they've got a lot of debt, and that's going to have to be dealt with.
Right.
And it took him another 2 days. In fact, at the same time, Hillary Clinton was on her Twitter feed saying, send the Navy, the hospital ship Comfort, send it now. They need it. 2 days later, they finally sent it. I mean, George W. Bush looks like the most efficient president in a national disaster after Katrina that there's ever been compared to what Donald Trump is doing in Puerto Rico. And, you know, yes, there's a lot of news. But the big news is something that Donald Trump himself created with this NFL, you know, griping
right.
about the NFL protests, which, you know, I'm all for that particular, you know, the protest. I'm in favor of the protest. I think it's great that the NFL athletes and the owners are, you know, protesting Donald Trump. But seriously, this is what he was obsessing about over the weekend while this disaster was unfolding, and we're seeing it on our screens. And I just can't believe that he's going to get away with it. I mean, he's just basically kind of, well, you know, in fact, on Wednesday, they asked him about why they hadn't given a waiver to the Jones Act, which is this sort of archaic law that says that you can't send foreign ships in these circumstances. And he said, well, I mean, he said it right out. Well, the shipping industry doesn't want it. By the way, they waived it for Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma. It's just going to Puerto Rico that they're doing. He says, oh, the shipping industry doesn't want it. You know, I mean, this is what we're dealing with. I mean, I'm astonished. If he gets away with this, essentially ignoring a humanitarian disaster with millions of American citizens, you know, I honestly don't know if there are any limits. I don't know what he could do that would basically change people's views of him. I just don't know what it could be. I mean, this is absolutely horrifying.
I mean, in that respect, it is a massive failure by the media and by, I mean, activists. I mean, at one point at the beginning of the week, it was understandable to the extent that there are amazing technical limitations in terms of the ability to report on this. But we have, over the course of the week, we've seen repeated pleas by the mayor of San Juan. At one point, she was breaking down on television. And what is, you know, truly stunning, I mean, not just the, I mean, we should say, and I think you mentioned that the Jones Act was, what it basically does is it says that there are only specific ports where ships, foreign ships bringing any goods can dock in the United States in their first touch with the United States. Puerto Rico is not one of those places, which in and of itself is problematic in a non-emergency situation. But in the context of this emergency, we saw the Jones Act suspended when gas prices during Irma were threatened on the East Coast. And the idea that it wouldn't happen now is really inexplicable in many respects. And the idea that we don't have C-30s dropping supplies, the idea that we
exactly.
do, you know, it took so long. I mean, all of these things, I want to take a break here, Digby, but when we come back, we have two questions, really. I mean, why is the American public so slow to respond to this when it's in mainland United States, you don't see that same lack of outrage? And why is the president
more or less ignoring this problem, I mean, to the extent that one can, and be president. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
And we're down, we go.
Insight Daily Radio. Mike Papantonio is a leading trial lawyer, the television host of America's Lawyer, and prolific author. His latest novel, Law and Vengeance, is an action-packed legal thriller with his main character, Gina Romano, in the crosshairs of America's largest arms manufacturer. We spoke with him about the book and the real-life issues that inform and inspire his writing.
I ended up having being involved in really complex cases. I came at it as a prosecutor and ended up having to handle some of the biggest cases in the country almost immediately against the asbestos manufacturers and pharmaceutical manufacturers. And in there, what happens is you develop a specialty, and this specialty is trial law. Most people believe that everybody's a trial lawyer, and they're not. The truth is, I think it's less than 1/3 of 1% of lawyers in this country are actually trial lawyers with trial skills that handle the kind of complex cases that I'm talking about. And so I ended up there. And it's interesting. By being there, it gave me kind of an interesting view of the world that maybe most people don't see, because I'm always on the other side of a table against a corporation that's created a pharmaceutical that's killing people, or a corporation that's polluting our waterways or our air knowingly, or a Wall Street entity that's stealing from mom and pop. So I always see that part of the story, and I collect the documents and I take the depositions and I try the cases. And in there, most of these books that I write kind of write themselves, you know, because they're all based on actual events, actual cases that I handle.
That's trial lawyer, television host, and author Mike Papantonio on his latest novel, Law and Vengeance, which has just been released. Insight Daily Radio.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about the incredible lack of urgency that we have seen around what was happening in Puerto Rico this week. And it's only going to get worse. And I think I would hope that as we are now, you know, a week plus out or so from the storm, that at the very least, we'll be able to get news crews in there that will hopefully communicate just how dire the situation is on this island. And it has been very odd, to say the least, to observe just how disinterested Donald Trump seems to be in what's going on in Puerto Rico. You mentioned his series of tweets, which spent as much time talking about Puerto Rico has to repay its debt, and they have a bad infrastructure, than it was like the horror of what's happened there. I mean, 80% at a minimum of the agricultural business industry, I mean, sector in Puerto Rico has been completely wiped out. And when you contemplate where they get a lot of their food, those islands had been wiped out weeks before, or I should say a week or two before. We had refugees on Puerto Rico from these other islands, including the American Virgin Islands, but also other islands that were devastated by the hurricanes in this season. And you mentioned earlier that Donald Trump was late in sending the massive medical ship that we have. There seems to be now we're hearing that supposedly the administration is preventing lawmakers from heading down to Puerto Rico.
and U.S. Virgin Islands. This is according to aides of these congressional lawmakers, which I imagine on some level is a function of Donald Trump wants to be the first person to go there from Washington to I don't want other people basically who have access to the media explaining what's going on there. I mean, this is really stunning. And I can't help but think that, A, the reason why the American public is not as keyed into it is because of, at the very least, a certain amount of, I don't know, colonial perspective on Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is an afterthought. And then I would layer in another level of racism. And then I would say with Donald Trump, it's probably rather similar. Racism might go to the fore, but also Puerto Rico doesn't vote in presidential elections. They gave 70% of their Republican caucus vote to Marco Rubio. And I think he just thinks, I get nothing out of them anyways.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. It's obvious to me that, you know, I mean, first of all, I mean, the polling says that almost half of Americans don't know that Puerto Ricans are Americans, that they have U.S. citizenship. And so, I haven't even been sure that Donald Trump knew that, to be honest. I mean, I guess he must, but he hasn't said anything like that. He hasn't used the words, you know, our fellow Americans or, you know, we've got U.S. citizens. He's never said that. So, you know, for all I know, he doesn't know that. And I think it's fairly clear that if he does know it, he's not real sure that's the way it ought to be. Because one of his, you know, the tenets of his immigration policy and refugee policy, as it's coming out, is that he demands that people speak English. Well, a lot of Puerto Ricans don't. They're Americans who do not speak English. And I can totally imagine that he finds that unacceptable. And he has a long history. I mean, he did say the other day that he was in, you know, that he, coming from New York, he had dealt with a lot of Puerto Ricans and he knew Puerto Ricans, et cetera, et cetera. Well, he also has a history of denying housing to Puerto Ricans,
right,
and being sued by the federal government for discrimination on that basis, that African Americans as well. So yeah, I mean, that may be his only real experience is denying them housing. So this, you know, this whole attitude, I mean, it just, I don't think there's any doubt that the ethnic makeup of Puerto Rico plays into this lack of interest in what is going on down there at a time of a major, major disaster. I mean, this is really bad, and there is the repercussions are going to be enormous. And I just, I can't, you know, like I sort of, you know, kiddingly, you know, in a very dark way was kind of tweeting last week about, you know, can we send Harry Connick Jr. down there so that maybe, you know, somehow or another we'll start to see this as the major disaster it was. He, you'll recall, was the one who went into the Superdome after Katrina in the dark, and suddenly people were going, oh my God, what is going on there? It took
right.
that. So, you know, this is, I don't, and I guess he's going to get away with it. I mean, this is what astonishes me. I just can't get over the fact that the President of the United States is able to do this. I mean, he is breaking every rule, every rule.
I mean, what do you think? There is just a certain amount of fatigue that is involved with Donald Trump. Is there some type of, have people basically just said like, okay, this is it? I mean, we don't have, you know, going forward, we're just going to be, you know, we can't have any expectations of Donald Trump. And I mean, on some level, it's like it's almost as if, you know, the country is reacting to a pathogen that they cannot get rid of. And it's just sort of like building defense mechanisms. But I mean, you just don't get the sense. I mean, you know, I keep returning to this notion of just, you know, we talk about white supremacy. And you talk about the idea of where, from whence the notion of Black Lives Matter comes from, that they're simply amongst the levers of power and communications within this country, dominated by white people. There is just not the same level of concern for people's lives, which are not white. And it's hard not to come to that conclusion with what we're seeing. But we have to take a break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire. Heather Parton will be joining me in the next hour. We'll be right back with more. Just ahead, why Trump's statements on NFL players might just be a cover-up for all the losses he's been taking lately. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back with Dave Zirin from Edge of Sports.
Standing in the corner, studying the lights. Dreaming of escape.
Insight Daily Radio. Mike Papantonio is a leading trial lawyer, the television host of America's Lawyer, and prolific author. His latest novel, Law and Vengeance, is an action-packed legal thriller with his main character, Gina Romano, in the crosshairs of America's largest arms manufacturer. We spoke with him about the book and the real-life issues that inform and inspire his writing.
Gina Romano is one of the main protagonists in this book. I thought it was an interesting character because what's happened in the legal profession, and it's appalling. You would think, especially in the legal profession, that women should have every opportunity to excel, that they should that there should be a reflection of the percentages of how many women are in this profession. There should be a reflection of percentage in the leadership structures, in seeing the best trial lawyers being female. We ought to incorporate something that looks like females are being treated fairly in this business, and we don't. The glass ceiling in the practice of law is no different anywhere else. But over the years, I've worked with some of the most talented female trial lawyers, and Gina Romano is kind of a composite of that. You know, she has the tenacity, she has the compassion, she has the intellect, she has the training, she just has it all. And when I really see a very talented female trial lawyer, that's what I see. So she's a creation from all that. People that I've actually tried cases with, women I've tried cases with, and women I've tried cases against. And that's where Gina Romano comes from.
That's trial lawyer, television host, and author Mike Papantonio on his latest novel, Law and Vengeance, which has just been released. Insight Daily Radio.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. This week, the media was dominated by Trump's reaction to NFL players protesting the injustice of policing in this country upon black Americans. The unprecedented statements by Trump in regards to a U.S. president addressing a sport may have just been a diversion from the fact that he's been on quite a losing streak lately. Here to discuss, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, Dave Zirin. So, Dave, let's back up just a little bit. I imagine some of the people who are listening to us, it's hard to believe that anybody wouldn't obviously know that there's some controversy involving Donald Trump and NFL players who were kneeling or taking a knee, as they say, during the national anthem. But just catch people up if they haven't been aware of what's actually been going on for the past year and a half now or so.
Sure. Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, all of this starts really in the summer of 2016 with the police killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. And with those killings, I mean, Colin Kaepernick, who had been doing his own reading and his own study and was auditing a class at Berkeley, this is, of course, the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, made the decision that he was not going to stand for the national anthem. And this wasn't anything, Colin Kaepernick, whom I've gotten to know, this is a very introverted person. He's not someone looking for the spotlight. If he was, believe me, he'd be on every TV show right now because everybody's trying to get him. And he's choosing to not speak. But Colin Kaepernick made the personal decision that he wasn't going to stand for the anthem. And then a reporter found him and said, hey, why aren't you doing this? And Colin Kaepernick just went off and said, I'm not going to stand for a flag while black people are killed in the streets and police get away with murder. That's how it started. And then Kaepernick took that knee week in, week out for 4 months. Other players joined in. Some raised fists. Some sat down. teammates on the 49ers rallied around him. He actually ended up having a great season last year, playing on a terrible team. And then at age 29, he found himself out of the league in a case that I think pretty nakedly is a case of political blackballing. And he did all this even though he was getting death threats. He became a punchline, more punch than punchline for Donald Trump on the campaign trail. I mean, he really weathered a great deal, but came out of it at the other side. I mean, really in a great place, like mentally, a great place organizationally. He's given away hundreds of thousands of dollars to different groups around the country. I mean, it really special stuff that he's done. I mean, raising money for food for people in Somalia. I mean, to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, he's become this remarkable figure in American life, yet still blackballed from the National Football League and still an object of derision and hatred by the right-wing echo chamber. And, you know, Colin Kaepernick is fine with that. But you fast forward now, and what happened before the start of this NFL season was not just Colin Kaepernick's inability to find a job, but, of course, Charlottesville. Nazis marching in the street, Donald Trump saying very fine people march with a swastika, and, of course, the murder of Heather Heyer. And with that, you have the start of the NFL season, and players like Michael Bennett, members of the Cleveland Browns, Marshawn Lynch, choosing to sit, raise their fist, or kneel during the anthem. But it didn't really reach more than 9 or 10 players in total who were doing it week in, week out. And Donald Trump, you know, who has this lizard brain instinct for who to isolate and who to demonize and who to make feel like they're somehow less than human for his base and for his audience. And he also seems to get like this when his legislative agenda stalls.
Right.
Not so coincidentally. It's like when things are failing for him, the health care bill floundering, Donald Trump, you know, and supporting a candidate in Alabama for Senate who, as of the time we're doing this interview, looks like he's going to lose to the person supported by the alt-right and Steve Bannon. Donald Trump goes to Alabama.
Let me just put a fine point on that, because Luther Strange, who Donald Trump is supporting, is also Mitch McConnell's candidate. And I think more than any other dynamic that's going on here, I think that explains it. It's, you know, Donald Trump, when he loses legislatively, I mean, he's done that time and time again. But when Donald Trump feels that in some way his relationship to nativists, to racists, to civic nationalists is in some way threatened, he does stuff like this. And his support for Luther Strange has him at odds with Steve Bannon. And he looks like he is siding with the globalists, with the Washington establishment. So this is the way that he brandishes his bona fides, by basically going out there and choosing someone who is not white. I mean,
right.
That's like when he's looking for a target, that it seems to be the primary qualification that he's looking for.
Right. And we hear it referred to in the mainstream media sometimes almost like way too delicately as culture war politics. It's not culture war. It's pretty naked racism with just enough
Right. Sort
of like wiggle room and a patina of sort of like patriotism, real America stuff that you can say, what? It has nothing to do with race. I didn't say anything about race. I'm just calling on black dissenters to get fired in front of an all-white Alabama audience. How can that have anything to do with race? And what Donald Trump didn't understand with this speech is that he wasn't just going after 9 players, 10 players, 11 players. He was going after the NFL community. And Donald Trump, you know, he never played football the same way he was never in the military. And he's such a, like, this maelstrom of toxic masculinity that he lives vicariously through a lot of these people, whether you're talking about soldiers, whether you're talking about football players, and I think
truck drivers. He has the same relationship with big trucks and fire department trucks. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
I mean, his obsession over the size of his hands, his sexually predatory behavior. I mean, really, it doesn't take Freud to figure out where he's coming from with this stuff. It's not that complicated. And so he goes after not just these NFL players, but he goes after a league that he describes as being too soft. And times for the days when more players were getting traumatic brain injuries. And so what Donald Trump didn't understand is that he messed up on two fronts. And I really do think he messed up with this. I don't think the politics and the optics of this are good for him at all, beyond the hardest of the hardcore of his base. And I think people should reject any analysis that says, like, Trump is winning this argument or whatever. I think it looks flailing and pathetic. So it's like two things, though, that Trump didn't understand he was stepping in. The first is that when it comes to NFL players, and I know this from talking to these guys, they believe in this thing that they call the brotherhood, which is kind of like an I Am Spartacus thing of you attack one of us, you attack all of us. So even if these players, many of whom might have even voted for Trump, many of whom didn't vote at all, some of whom do not agree with even the issue of that we have to stand up to police brutality. But when you call for NFL players to be fired, when you say the phrase son of a bitch to talk about an NFL player, which they interpreted immediately as they're attacking the mom of our teammates. I mean, they're calling like these women who are very active in the locker room in terms of creating community, the mothers of NFL players. I mean, people took that extremely personally. And saying the game was too soft and it was boring because it was too soft, that goes after the owners, some of the very people who've given Donald Trump millions and millions mm-hmm. of dollars in this campaign. And one thing about billionaires is they don't like being told what to do, and they don't like their bottom line being challenged. So, and I'm trying to even rack my brain like of anything parallel to this in the history of the United States, where these plutocrats who wrote these seven-figure checks to Donald Trump are within 48 hours doing nationally televised or taking part in nationally televised demonstrations against him. And of course, it wasn't just in the NFL. This has spread throughout the NBA now in terms of the comments of players right. like LeBron James and Steph Curry, aided by, you know, Donald Trump having like another culture war, if you will, hissy fit online because his legislative agenda is failing, Luther Strange, all the stuff that you said, healthcare. And so he goes after the Golden State Warriors and disinvites them from the White House. I'm sure that the fact that Golden State is from the Bay Area has nothing to do with this calculation whatsoever.
We got to take a break here, but I want to ask you, I mean, we've gotten to the place where the fight here and the attention is now between Donald Trump and these institutions of football or other sports. And you argue that Donald Trump is losing because of that. But I also wonder if what Colin Kaepernick first took a knee for is also losing. And I want to talk about that when we come back. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Dave Zirin about this unprecedented situation where the president of the United States is attacking football because of protest by Colin Kaepernick. We'll be right back after this.
Insight Daily Radio. Mike Papantonio is a leading trial lawyer, the television host of America's Lawyer, and prolific author. His latest novel, Law and Vengeance, is an action-packed legal thriller with his main character, Gina Romano, in the crosshairs of America's largest arms manufacturer. We spoke with him about the book and the real-life issues that inform and inspire his writing.
When you read these books, you're going to hear me talk about what I call biostitutes. Biostitute in this industry, we see it whether we're dealing with pharmaceutical, whether we're dealing with pollution cases. Right now, I'm working on the national opioid case where the industry dumped billions and billions of opioids on American citizens, and they understood exactly what they were doing. They're creating an addiction catastrophe. Well, the industry is able to go to the biggest universities in the country and hire what I call biostitutes. A biostitute may be a scientist that will say anything for the right amount of money. They're going to tell you, yeah, the conduct of this corporation was completely appropriate. The product they sold was completely safe. They will say anything that needs to be said for the right number of millions of dollars. And right now, that industry is just expanding. expanding, bigger than I've ever seen. I've been doing this for 35 years. So when you see my books, whether it's Law and Disorder, whether it's Law and Vengeance, the next one coming out is Law and Addiction, and the one after that is Law and Terror. When you read those books, you'll really see me beating on these bioinstitutes, because it is an industry that runs the risk of destroying everything we believe, and that is, we believe that capitalism works fairly. When you put a bioinstitute in the process, it doesn't.
That's trial lawyer, television host, and author Mike Papantonio on his latest novel, Law and Vengeance, which has just been released. Insight Daily Radio.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with the host of Edge of Sports podcast, Dave Zirin, about his piece in The Nation, Taking a Knee is Not About Abstract Unity, but Racial Justice. So, Dave, when we broke, you had basically walked us through the history of what led up to Donald Trump in Alabama last Friday night, calling out Colin Kaepernick, telling the NFL owners they should go down, and if they see somebody taking the knee during the national anthem, they should tell that son of a bitch to get off the field. And then he was bemoaning the fact that that football has become wussified, basically taking a page from Rush Limbaugh. I mean, this is the talk radio president. It all makes sense if you contemplate that Rush Limbaugh has made this complaint about football forever. And I imagine the same complaints about Kaepernick. But here's the question. I don't know if you saw Shannon Sharp, and we saw, and we should say, like, it's been interesting over the, you know, up until last week, this Kaepernick protest, which Eric Reed wrote in the New York Times earlier this week, they originally decided, they settled on taking a knee after the third or fourth protest that Kaepernick had had during that, specifically because they wanted to show some respect to the flag. But they wanted to make a point that black lives were under threat in this country, and they wanted to protest. And we've seen over the past couple of months, different players in the NFL, some commentators saying Kaepernick is clearly being blacklisted because he's qualified to be at the very least a starting quarterback for the NFL, or I should say at the very least a backup. So we have this now has exploded, and Shannon Sharp spoke on his program on ESPN, I believe it is, and he made the point that there's a lot of hypocrisy going on, and you were starting to head there too, as you describe this now a fight between Donald Trump and the institution and the honor of football, as opposed to what Colin Kaepernick was originally protesting.
Yes, and that's exactly what I wrote about in my last Nation column as well. And that really, because you said it really well, Sam, when you said, like, what's also he's also losing. Donald Trump is losing, I would argue, but perhaps the biggest loser, for lack of a better word here, is what the original intention was of this in particular, especially, I mean, when you see, like, Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, someone who played for a segregated football team in Arkansas, and last year warned his players that they could get fired for taking a knee, takes a knee himself before Monday Night Football. And I'll just read you, like, just very, 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 very briefly what I wrote, because I believe it's, like, really,
please
really
do.
Strongly.
Please do.
Is that I wrote, we absolutely cannot let this debate to become one of unity versus the flag, or a liberal brand of bumper sticker patriotism, you know, like, patriotism is patriotic. I mean, I'm sorry, protest is patriotic. I'm sure you've seen that bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Versus Donald Trump's, which is, you know, stand or die, love it or leave it. That's not the debate, and that's not what the debate should be. That's what the NFL's turning it into, unity versus disunity, unity versus division. And I'm not saying that unity is something that we shouldn't be striving for in the face of Trump's toxic bullying, but there still is this issue that police killings are actually up in 2017 compared to 2016. People are protesting in St. Louis this week about just another absolutely outrageous verdict in the case of a police killing. You know, this issue has not ended. And yet that message is something that's been dramatically obscured by all of this. And we have to keep, I think, pushing on that front to say that, you know, taking a knee was not about protest in the abstract. It's not about free speech. It wasn't about unity. It was about raising attention to this very issue and using the space of the anthem to raise this issue of the gap between what we're told the flag represents and people's actual lived experiences. And so it becomes that bigger question of, do you view the United States as a finished product, or do you view it as something that has certain ideals that we constantly have to strive and fight to reach? That is getting lost in dramatic fashion.
You know, we only have 3 minutes left, Dave, but I noticed that what's fascinating to me about this dynamic is that this mirrors very much, you know, what we see across the spectrum of political questions in this country, where Donald Trump and sort of just process and mores takes the place of the substance of the political complaints, right? I mean, it is there's politics, and then there's sort of like norms, and you can see this dichotomy that we have, you know, where people are talking about, like, well, we want to fight for actual policies as opposed to just be just provide dissent. This is not just about resisting. It is actually about trying to attain something. And it's fascinating to see this protest get subsumed. I mean, it was funny. Shannon Sharp said, you know, I appreciate Tom Brady, because he said he wouldn't kneel, and he wouldn't kneel before. He just said a couple weeks ago that Kaepernick should be hired. But, you know, that's what's so important here. I mean, you probably have a better sense of this. How is Kaepernick thinking about trying to bring this back to the original point that he was trying to make? Because that challenge is even harder now.
Yeah, and I got to say, like, you know, Colin is being very tight-lipped about this. I mean, and that's just also his nature in many respects. And he also believes that to speak out at this point, I mean, it's less for him to do and more for people who believe in this cause to do. And I think that it's a very interesting point. He also thinks that his silence is a political act unto itself. Mm. And I respect that, too, because I'll tell you, what Colin Kaepernick is doing right now through his silence, it's a hell of a counter example of this Trump era, and I would argue that the owners of the NFL share this, which is this constant toxic narcissism of, you know, who gets the attention, who gets the headlines, and this whole Trumpian approach of, it doesn't even matter what people say about you as long as they're talking about you and as long as they spell your name right, and that's all that matters, when there are actual politics here that matter. And it's a move away from the Kardashianization of our culture and of our politics. And so I find myself, as the days go by, respecting Colin Kaepernick's silence more and more in the face of that. But, I think that, will this even be reclaimed? I mean, is really going it's a subjective question. It's interviews like this. It's the heroism of Shannon Sharp using his platform on Fox Sports to talk about these issues. I mean, it's going to take the conscious intervention of people to have this discussion and make sure the discussion isn't steered astray. And, you know, we'll see if it happens.
Dave Zirin, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Dave Zirin is the nation's sports editor. He is the author of 8 books on the politics of sports. Most recently, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. He also hosts his own weekly SiriusXM show, Edge of Sports Radio. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.
Insight Daily Radio. Mike Papantonio is a leading trial lawyer, the television host of America's Lawyer, and prolific author.
His latest novel, Law and Vengeance, is an action-packed legal thriller with his main character, Gina Romano, in the crosshairs of America's largest arms manufacturer. We spoke with him about the book and the real-life issues that inform and inspire his writing.
I think the fiction is easier because the stories kind of tell themselves because of what I do. Now, it may if I didn't do what I did for a living and I said, well, let me imagine what happens with a whistleblower. Let me imagine what happens when a pharmaceutical company kills people with a dangerous pharmaceutical. Let me imagine what happens when a mega corporation pollutes an entire waterway for 300,000 people. Let me imagine that. It's tough to imagine. But it's very easy to write when you're actually in the middle of that and you're experiencing what's happening firsthand. So that's a huge advantage that I have, you know, doing this type of writing. So I would say really writing the fiction is a little easier than writing the kind of motivational book for, you know, the types of things I was doing before. You know, if you're not careful, motivational books come out sounding a little Pollyannish and you go, gee whiz, you know, I don't know if this is going to change anybody's life. But when you write a fiction book and it's based on reality, it just seems to very often write itself.
That's trial lawyer, television host, and author Mike Papantonio on his latest novel, Law and Vengeance, which has just been released. Insight Daily Radio.